You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 17th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, Sarah Leonard, senior editor at The Nation magazine, on her new piece, No Sleep Till World Domination, how the work cultures of Wall Street and Silicon Valley create cult-like atmospheres and justify their financial and political power. Also,
if you're looking on the, if you're watching on YouTube, by the way, you'll notice Michael is dressed for a Silicon Valley type interview, isn't
he? I'm wearing a very Zuckerberg-esque hoodie. I was going to save that joke for when she was on the air, but I'll just
repeat it. My apologies.
I'll just repeat it. No problem. Also, I'm going to put it in quotation marks. I'm sorry. The referendum in Crimea. I don't think that's exactly the word when you have armed soldiers and not really a choice in how you vote. But nonetheless, a vote in Crimea to return to Russia. Also, pro-anti-abortion fanatics, some of the same people that we were talking about last week, that Sam was talking about last week with Irene Karman, are targeting specific people on Facebook, posting their names, their faces, asking people to pray for them. And a millennial response to Abby Huntsman's regurgitation of the same old nonsense on Social Security.
We also got, I don't know if you guys noticed this past weekend, as your city streets filled, as the White Man March happened this past Saturday. We'll talk about that more later. Also, today is St. Patrick's Day. And some very interesting things are going on with exactly who is, or I should say isn't, marching in certain parades, and who is, or I should say isn't, supporting and sponsoring certain parades. Again, we'll get to that later in the program.
Dude, it's St. Patty's Day. It's not supposed to be all political and stuff. I don't know what your problem is. It's a little Scott Brown in honor of St. Patty's Day. So we have a great show.
We do.
I just want to say really quickly, I think we took care of it, but they're doing these fire alarm tests in this building, and I think we have it cleared for the show.
On top of that also, though,
yeah,
right adjacent – not adjacent, on the same side – next to us, the room right next to us, yeah, is the bathroom. And usually this isn't a problem, except they've decided to completely gut the entire bathroom and renovate.
But I think those guys are actually – I think that's cool. But we apologize in advance if there's any distractions. I don't think there will be. We'll be right back with Sarah Leonard on MB Squared Monday on the Majority Report.
Check out the real situation. Nation war against nation. Where did it all begin? When will it end? Well, it seemed like total destruction. No one can stop us now.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Sorry about that, folks. We just had a brief technical problem with our Google phone, actually. But joining me now is Sarah Leonard. She's a senior editor at The Nation magazine, and she's the author of a great new article in Al Jazeera, which we're going to be discussing, No Sleep Till World Domination. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Very happy to have you on. This is a really fascinating piece that you wrote, basically contrasting and actually showing the overlaps between Wall Street and Silicon Valley work cultures and actually really the why we should care about them, frankly. But let's start by focusing on the beginning of your article. You're talking about some new moves that Wall Street banks are putting into place to basically reform or shorten somewhat the work hours that young analysts are putting in. Can you talk about why they're shortening those work hours? What's going on at these banks? What problems are they responding to?
Sure. So this is a move by some banks, most recently Credit Suisse, to cap the number of hours junior bankers can work. That includes maybe only being allowed to come in one day on the weekend instead of both days on the weekend.
Oh, God, don't get too lax here. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I know. It's a, it is oddly a significant cultural disruption in banking.
Right.
And what they're responding to is a lot of bad publicity around things like the death of a 21-year-old banking intern in the UK. He was at Bank of America. And he suffered a seizure, probably due to epilepsy, but probably triggered by having worked until 6 a.m. 3 days in a row. He had essentially worked 72 hours straight. Mm. And horrifying though this is, it's not really uncommon. And so this has become a source of bad publicity for banks, whereas interestingly, it used to be a source of good publicity. These were the hardest working people on earth. So now they're trying to sort of counter this by publicizing a reduction in work hours.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And actually, you quote some unnamed banker saying basically, hey, look, if you don't want to work those hours, you should find another line of work, essentially. So there's obviously mm-hmm. still some real clear vestiges of pride in that type of work culture. Why, though, do you think is our turn in how we think about that work culture, is that just reflecting the fact that more and more people, frankly, probably have a more accurate assessment of Wall Street in light of Wall Street essentially detonating the world economy in 2008? Like, what is leading to that transformation and perception of Wall Street work culture?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. When finance was at its peak in terms of prestige, they could do no wrong in the public perception. So they recruited students from Ivy League schools almost exclusively, or the top tier of finance did, and they worked extraordinarily long hours. And one function this had was to suggest that these were the smartest and hardest working people and therefore should not, for example, be regulated.
Right.
Because who was there who was smarter and harder working than these people who could possibly regulate them? And so with the decline in prestige of the industry, with the economic crash, as people came to see, well, maybe they're not so smart, this sort of system of engendering finance with all this prestige is sort of crumbling. And, you know, I think 10 years ago, they would never have thought of reducing work hours. But now that they can't claim immunity from bad judgment, people are wondering why these people need to be working around the clock. Is their work really so important? Are they really so smart that we need them on the job all of the time? Is it worth the lives of young interns? And the answer increasingly seems to be no, people aren't buying it.
Absolutely. So, and this is, and actually you're, you know, you were, I was reminded when I read this piece of people I know, in finance, and just even like this culture of actually bragging about, well, I, you know, I haven't had like a proper meal in days, or, well, hey, you know, I'm working with, you know, I should be in the hospital, but I'm working regardless. This kind of culture of bragging about having like no actual life and working through actually serious physical illness. But what's also really great about your piece, though, is you explain, and you're already explaining about why, I mean, sure, nobody likes to hear a story of an intern dying because they're working on PowerPoint till 5 a.m., but there is broader implications of this, and you talk about in the kind of elite ideology of today that there is the premium is placed on this certain very kind of narrow type of intelligence or intellect. And I think Chris Hayes has also kind of mentioned this as well. And there's implications from that. And we're going to move into Silicon Valley as you do later in the conversation. But what is it about this cult of smart and how that shows up in terms of why you should be impervious to regulation and how industries sort of prove themselves theoretically as being indispensable?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. I think this is a phenomenon captured actually really, really brilliantly in a book called Liquidated by Karen Ho, who's an anthropologist who actually worked on Wall Street for 2 years. And that was her anthropology work. it's a truly fascinating book. But one of the ways that this idea of smartness is perpetuated is by finance firms recruiting students from fancy schools, telling them that, so you went to the best school, you want to do an equally fancy thing after school, but you're not sure what it should be. It's confusing to graduate college. Come work for us at Goldman Sachs. We are the Princeton of work, of the work world. Mm-hmm. And so students go. And when these banks have meetings with investors, they bring along students who went to the same schools as the investors. They bring a Harvard guy and a Princeton guy. And so this produces this cycle of banks being supposedly full of the smartest people and continuing to be appealing to the people who make them look smart. They bring the brand of Harvard to Goldman. And so this reinforces, of course, this idea that these people are the smartest, and this benefits the banks by making them seem like they should be immune from regulation. So I've heard a lot of people in finance say, or they were, you know, maybe 5 years ago, a little longer before that, high finance is extremely complicated. If you don't work in it, you can't understand it, which of course means either that there should be no regulation or that the people who are doing the regulating should be drawn from the finance industry. Not a great system for regulation, obviously.
Right.
And so this sort of smartness, this idea of smartness, really benefits the industry by making them immune from the sort of checks that should be put on an extremely powerful, extremely wealthy industry.
Absolutely, and we're valorizing something. I mean, there's no cultural argument or political argument that says, hey, look, the task of educating a child through incredibly complex, you know, social, emotional, physical development and educational development is incredibly complicated and most people couldn't possibly understand it. So we're really just going to have to leave education policy to like teachers. There's no like
right.
equivalent.
This is definitely.
Right.
Yeah. This is a very narrow idea of what smartness is, obviously. And you can see it. I mean, this is really a sort of, this is domination by the finance industry and within the finance industry by the people at the top. This is domination coded as meritocracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we are dominating you. We are, you know, unleashing these insane derivatives. We are foreclosing on your house because we know best, because we're smart enough to get up here where we can do it. It's a sort of circular logic. It's a very narrow definition of smartness that serves these companies, obviously.
Right, right. I wouldn't be foreclosing on your house to begin with if I wasn't already sort of better, you know, completely justified in doing that from the beginning because I'm a superior person. And I mean, so, but clearly Silicon, and then actually I think the kind of final piece that's important about this Wall Street component and also in Silicon Valley when we get to that, that this kind of culture of abuse and exhaustion within the culture and also the kind of closed social networks drawing from specific pools of schools, but also fraternities, different social backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
that also is, you know, I mean, look, obviously the industry needs to be highly regulated, but even if you're talking in an internal culture, that's going to really disincentivize and clamp down the person saying, hey, these derivatives seem actually pretty reckless.
Certainly, yeah. Kevin Roos just put out an amazing book that is based on a set of interviews over a long period of time with some young bankers who were recruited after the crash. And his question going in is sort of, why are people still going to Wall Street after the crash? And it involves some of the ideas we're talking about what's considered smart, what's considered prestigious. But one of the points he makes is these people are so run down that one of them says, I'm just trying to keep from drowning.
Mm.
And, you know, of course, you know, pity Goldman. But these are very young people.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of authority in the workplaces where they're at. But more importantly, they're really not asking questions because they're exhausted and because they're working so hard and they're exhausted and they pretty much feel terrible all of the time. They are also involved in a sort of elaborate process of justifying to themselves why they're there. And that makes it very hard for them to ask questions. You know, they have to say, actually, banking serves a positive social purpose by distributing resources. You know, these really are the smartest people to handle finance. And of course, there are some bad apples, but basically this is a very important industry. And because they have to tell themselves these things to justify why they're absolutely killing themselves at these banks, sometimes literally, it does not leave a lot of space for critical thinking.
Right, right. So, but clearly, and we're seeing this, and as you say at the outset of your article, that Wall Street has obviously taken a brand beating at the very least. You know, substantively,
sure.
there's little to no accountability. There's certainly no criminal accountability. There's very little to no financial accountability. There's a bit of regulatory accountability, but not much. But definitely in terms of, I mean, I remember, you know, in college, like in 2006 or 2007, there was still much more of a, you know, even in a movie, like some guy could, you know, he would work at a hedge fund and then, you know, moonlight helping the environment or something. And that was like a really cool character. And that's all disappeared. And now, and that's partially what Wall Street is responding to. But what you identify in your piece so well is that this cult of smartness, it's not that the debranding of Wall Street has not gotten to that fundamental narrative. It's just migrated out west. And now we have Silicon Valley. And in honor of you, I should say, by the way, I'm wearing a very Zuckerberg-esque hoodie as I conduct this interview because I want to feel,
Terrific.
I want to be obviously creative and connected with my passion while we're talking. And, you know, so in Silicon Valley, and so Silicon Valley now has the reputation. I mean, even The Onion, you know, when Steve Jobs passed away, they did the joke was, you know, the last person in America who knew what he was doing died. And so there is a lot more cultural currency there. But you're saying that these same habits, both internally to the culture and externally in terms of what Silicon Valley is doing, and we're seeing this with things like the revelations about NSA and mass surveillance and connection between Silicon Valley and the inequality crisis. So there's this broader social implication. But then there's also a similar type of work culture. But in both cases, it's concealed by a very different brand positioning, a very different ideology. Explain that for us.
Yeah. Well, there are similarities and differences, I would say. I mean, the interesting thing about Silicon Valley is instead of everyone walking around like on Wall Street saying, oh, I haven't eaten a meal in days, like I haven't slept in 100 years, I'm charging so hard on this deal. Instead, you have this, it's very sort of amusingly West Coast, like sort of chill aesthetic.
Right.
So you have, you know, famously like the really hip offices where people are like riding scooters around. And the idea, of course, is that coding, which started out with certain countercultural origins, obviously not completely. The internet was more or less invented by the military, but there was a lot of interesting sort of countercultural work done with the internet early on and still is. And so the way that Silicon Valley talks about work is by arguing that people who work long hours are doing it because they love it.
Mm.
You know, I think it's less common on Wall Street you would have someone say, I just love making PowerPoints.
Right.
But in Silicon Valley, the idea, of course, is that you love to code. And so this gets used to sort of justify the long work hours. And instead of them being enforced in a really straightforward way, such as, you know, a superior calling you on the weekend and telling you to fix the typeface in a slide, you have policies like unlimited vacation days, which of course people don't take because you have to finish the same amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a somewhat more insidious enforcement of this work ethic, but people are also in Silicon Valley working insanely hard, and they've come up with all sorts of ways to valorize this in other ways. So I think a wonderful example is Sheryl Sandberg's so-called feminist manifesto, Lean In, which has been the subject of a lot of discussion. And I think my favorite piece on it was written by Kate Lossie at Dissent magazine, which made the point that Lean In codes itself as a feminist manifesto, so a value. You know, we're all feminists, sort of a progressive value. But what it's arguing is that you should work harder. That is the fundamental message of the book, is women can get ahead by working harder. But it's for this other value, it's for feminism. And so there are a lot of ways in the Valley of coding harder work as something sort of progressive.
So it's almost like, I know that Zizek, I think of him, that Slovenian guy, he kind of jokes about that he would prefer the boss that says, hey, like, shut the F up and get X, Y, and Z done. You're not my friend. Versus the boss who, you know, you go into the office, he puts your arm, you know, the arm around your shoulder and says, hey, man, like, you know, what's going on? And then at the same time, there's the same kind of drive of production behind it. So I guess that poses different. I mean, and I should say again, I mean, I reflecting again of people I know, certainly there are people I know in Silicon Valley where it doesn't seem all, you know, made up. They do seem more passionate about a given project. They do seem like they have maybe more opportunity to at least potentially work on something, you know, that isn't like just like a movie review app or something, but something that might actually be very socially useful. But that conversation poses its own challenges, because I guess again, we're just not being transparent about the actual work relationship. Is that really what it is? We're just not being clear about what's really happening.
Yeah, I think that's true, in that you know, these are people producing a lot of profit for the people who they work for,
right?
And so calling it just pleasure and using that as a way to take up all of their time is not great. But I also think it's worth distinguishing between individual coders or people who are interested in the sorts of technologies that they're working on day to day and their employers. So I think it's great to love what you do. That's terrific. And if a higher percentage of people are happier with the projects they're working on in the valley than on the street, great. But I think what gets left behind is this sort of everyone's just here doing what they love ethos has contributed to a reputation for the tech industry as being all sort of sunshine and light and good intentions. Famously, Google's slogan is, don't be evil.
Their old slogan. Haven't seen that for a while.
Oh, well, it was a good attempt to ditch it, I suppose.
Yeah.
It became untenable.
right.
But I think what's interesting is that more that these companies can sort of cultivate an image of good intentions and earnest interest in their subject matter, as opposed to a profit motive, the less harshly they're looked on by the media and ultimately then by regulators.
Right.
And I think that the industry gets away with quite a lot by on this sort of don't be evil ethos. And so whether or not individuals are happy doing their sorts of projects, I think it's worth looking at the industry more broadly and what justifying work on that happiness basis does for the overall image of an industry that's actually trying to get away with a lot.
You know, that's such a crucial point. This kind of image that these are just these sort of like herbivorous companies made up of nice people on, you know, bouncy balls making nice nifty things. And really, Silicon Valley is now at the heart of many. I mean, it's about spying and surveillance and the intelligence apparatus. It's how do we protect privacy and civil liberties in the future. It's certainly deeply connected with the inequality crisis, and then there's all sorts of racial and gender aspects to it. So, is it important then, flowing out of that we have? I think it was Yevgeny Morozov. I feel like he probably said this, but I'm not 100% sure. But he's a safe guy to say he would probably say this. But at any rate, but he was saying, when we talk about, you know, when we say big pharma, big oil, big finance, or you know, or even big government, there is a notion from whatever your ideological perspective. Like when I say big pharma, that probably means that I don't think that there are these lovely companies in New Jersey and Switzerland that are really just trying to help people's health. We know that there's another agenda. We still talk about Silicon Valley, like you're saying, and we still talk about the tech industry. We don't necessarily put that big in front of it. We don't necessarily think of it, as you say, as this is an industry with interests, with power, with a lot of influence. I mean, is that like the first part of the job, is getting Silicon Valley out of the self-help section and into the econ section?
yeah, Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the tech industry is difficult for people to pin down. I think when you talk about big oil, you generally know exactly what big oil wants.
Right.
You know, they want to drill for oil, and they don't want to be taxed, and they want to influence geopolitics such that they are able to drill in more places. With the tech industry, it's complicated because it's not always clear what the tech industry wants or if they know exactly what they want and how the interests are arranged against each other. So some tech companies might be for privacy regulations are like the big question.
Right.
So some parts of the tech industry benefit more from protections of citizens' privacy than others. And it's unclear how all of this is going to pan out. And I think it's more difficult to look at the tech industry as a block and say, well, here's what they want. That said, there are it's becoming increasingly clear, certainly some things the tech industry would not want, such as, you know, regulation of how social media companies and apps, for that matter, can use our data to sell us things. That's a very straightforward example. You know, obviously these companies profit primarily from encouraging us to share information about ourselves and then selling that information. So any regulation on that is going to run counter to the interests of the vast majority of what we would think of as the tech industry. And that's also an example of something we might really want regulated.
We are
sharing a lot of information about ourselves now. And that's another sort of profit-making activity which is coded as pleasure and not work. Despite the fact that we are making a profit for these companies, we are certainly not compensated for sharing things on Facebook, not with money anyway. And so as that is more and more encouraged, we're going to want to take a closer and closer look at what is being done with that data, whether that data is shared with the government, for example, as it has been, and whether or not we are actually able to do that, whether we're able to get a handle on that sort of regulation, is going to depend in part on how the public perceives the tech industry. And for that reason, I think it's very important to sort of pierce through this very charming image that the industry has cultivated for itself.
Absolutely. And actually, as a final question before we wrap up, I think the other thing that you raise right there that's so important is that in both cases, and this is very much the kind of ideological disposition of the tech industry, and not just the tech industry, but, you know, very much at the heart of the tech industry is the notion that in all of these cases, it really is just our individual choice. You know, the response being, if you're concerned about your information, don't use social media, right? If you're concerned about whatever, you know, and just as the corollary is, hey, they work 17 hours a day because they love it. There is a discouragement from looking at context and institutions, and everything comes down to, hey, what do you feel like doing?
Absolutely. And I think in terms of our use of social media, for example, this is really, really insidious. Because, of course, people can say, okay, you don't like what Facebook does with data, stop using Facebook. But Facebook is a giant company. Everybody uses it. It's a way that people find out about events and communicate with their friends. And that fact itself is Facebook's doing, in part, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Facebook did not become massive and pervade our entire lives by accident. They spent a lot of money to expand, and they were very strategic about it. And of course, we participated as consumers of Facebook. But it is, I think, inaccurate to say that it is now, you know, it's completely our choice to use Facebook. It's sort of our choice. We sort of consent. We're sort of compelled. I think it's a much grayer area than is acknowledged by people who make those sorts of arguments. There's actually a truly wonderful article at the new inquiry this week called Of Being Numerous by Natasha Leonard, who makes an argument about activism and surveillance, saying, you know, we now use things like Twitter and Facebook to further our activism. And of course, we need to use these tools because the people we are activists against use big media tools. But those tools also operate to surveil us. And that's scary. And so we're caught in this sort of bind with the tools that we use. And so because we find ourselves in this situation where these technologies really pervade our everyday lives and our activism, for that matter, I think it should matter to us to be imposing some big regulation on these companies so that if they want to be such a big part of our lives, they have to operate in a way that respects our rights as citizens and you know, as people who should not be default surveilled.
Absolutely. Well, no one is too smart to be heavily regulated. That's a very clear lesson from your piece, and yeah, and just from the reality we've been living under. Sarah Leonard, the piece is "No Sleep Till World Domination." It's at Al Jazeera. Definitely recommend everybody read it. We have a link to it on the Majority Report website. Thank you so much for joining me, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Take care.
You too.
All right, folks. Really fascinating. I remember one time talking and this girl got very angry at me. She said, "Facebook does all this for you for free and you use it. And how dare you question how they make money?" It was one of the most incredible.
Wait, who said that to you?
I was at
a friend of yours?
Not a friend. It was definitely not a friend. I mean, it was an acquaintance, and it was at a bar, and somebody, and it wasn't even like I didn't want to have this conversation to begin with.
What did you say to her?
I'm at a bar having a drink, somebody with a couple of friends, and somebody mentioned something about, because at that time I was actually doing some work with a firm that was in Silicon Valley that does all open source stuff. And somehow I said, I was thinking about this stuff a little bit. I'd never really thought about it before. And I said, you know, there's a really big question about basically how we're going to regulate these companies, because their whole business model is based off of us giving them free information and then selling stuff back to us. And that raises a lot of questions. So all I said, and she was like, "I cannot believe, like, you pay taxes for the sidewalk, right?" And it was amazing, like, the way it was totally conflated. I was like, yeah, I'm happy to pay taxes for a sidewalk. It's a completely – well, in one way, it's a completely different thing. And the second thing is actually, yes, if everybody is using a sidewalk, just like Sarah Leonard was saying, that means we got to have different rules around it. You can't, like, opt out of sidewalks. And but apparently she saw me as being very ungrateful to Zuckerberg and co.
How dare you not kiss the ground Mark Zuckerberg walks on?
It was amazing. I mean, I
kiss it, Michael. Kiss it.
Kiss it.
Kiss it. Kiss it now.
I was just like, listen, like, I've hung out with, like, kings and queens, so I got no problem kissing a ring. I'm just raising questions, brah.
Did you see this story that we could talk about it more later? But see this story. Basically, Mark Zuckerberg this past week calls Obama to complain about the NSA and then writes a post on Facebook bragging about how he basically called Obama to complain about the NSA.
"Hey, Mark, so great to hear from you. Yeah. Wow. Really appreciate your perspective. Yeah. Wow.
It's not very nice of you, Mr. Obama, to hurt on our money-making capabilities, because we need to be the ones who take all this data from everybody and know everything about everyone, so there's no private life. But we need to do it so we can make money.
Trying it. Sorry
to... If you do it, it hurts our ability to make money.
Sorry to cut in on your market there, Mark. But look, if I want to have a discussion with you on civil liberties, that's right after the discussion I'll have with you on how to forge and sustain successful human relationships." And then Obama would do that little, like... You know, that kind of tight laugh he gives when he doesn't like somebody.
I don't really get what you're talking about, Mr. Obama.
Of course you wouldn't.
I don't understand.
Should we go straight to the better half?
Would you like a Facebook hoodie?
I've got it, man. Look at this. Hoodied up.
So really quick, but before we get to the funner half of the show, let me just get to this St. Paddy's Day thing really quick. So today is St. Patrick's Day, and it's a very historical St. Patrick's Day because there is some massive shunning, I guess you can call it, of the various St. Patrick's Day events that are not inclusive to the LGBT community. We have mayors in both New York City and Boston who have said they are not going to march in the parade today. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and the entire city council announced they'd be boycotting the New York City St. Patrick's Day parade, along with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who announced he will also be boycotting his own city's parade.
Nice.
In addition to...
Hey, Marty, why are you going to be such a, like, I mean, I guess in a certain sense, like a kind of a retard? Send his Scott Brown here.
And in that sense, also, I'll give you a little bit of, man, de Blasio, why aren't you marching in the parade? What's wrong with you?
No one loves the homos more than me, as long as they make at least 6 figures a year.
Yeah.
But the parade's a parade.
Yeah, I love parades.
I love them so
much.
Man,
Bloomberg here. I'm watching the parade.
Well, there's more Bloomberg for
later.
Yeah,
we'll get to Bloomberg more later.
He might actually even approve of this one, to be fair.
Yeah.
Bloomberg was pretty impeccable on equality for
That's
gay
true.
People.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But I love a good parade.
I love a good parade.
But back to the more serious issues here.
Yes.
Not only are the mayors of both New York City and Boston, and I'm sure other lawmakers across the nation have also decided to boycott smaller St. Patrick's Day parades, but the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York City is losing some financial support. Following Sam Adams' lead, who originally said they were already going to boycott the Boston parade because of their inability to include out LGBT community members, because God forbid we have those LGBT community members marching in a parade. They might, you know, spice up the boring parade that is the St. Patrick's Day parade. Guinness and Heineken have pulled their sponsorship of the New York City St. Patrick's Day parade. A Heineken spokesperson explains simply, we believe in equality for all. Guinness's statement followed an announcement that the historic Stonewall Inn would drop the beer from its shelves if Guinness stood by its sponsorship of the parade. However, Guinness also added that we were hopeful that the policy of exclusion would be reversed for this year's parade. As we see, this will not come to pass. Guinness has withdrawn its participation.
Nice.
So good for you, Sam Adams. Good for you, Guinness. Good for you, Heineken. Folks, it's 2014. Come on now. Really. Come on.
It's time to grow up.
It's time to, for real.
You know what? I mean, we had Austin Ruse on, and the thing that stuck with me when he was on with Sam a couple of weeks ago was the fact that you literally had a 50-year-old guy, and I'm not saying this to keep, like, raining on him. He's obviously very troubled, but he's, you know, he's educated. When he's not a complete friggin' lunatic, he's probably, like, he's a nice enough guy in a certain way, right? Until he, like, really lost it. He kept saying the parts don't fit. I mean, it's a 50-year-old man, and that was his argument. It's pathetic. Like, come on. Grow up.
There's no room for the LGBT community in our parade where men wear skirts.
Yeah. You're goddamn right.
There's no room for any of that.
Dude, I asked the king once about that, and he told me it was totally different kind of skirt, so I don't know what you're talking about.
The parts don't fit in our parade.
Should we go straight to the...
Let's go straight to the better half.
We're going
to
go straight to the better half. We have plenty, or the fun half, as we have now deemed it. I have a millennial response to Abby Huntsman's millennial call to gut Social Security. We're going to do a quick Ukraine roundup. And also talk about something really disturbing with these extreme anti-reproductive health people. Just touch on that for a moment. What else we got coming up? And of course, your IMs. we can't take phone calls because something's going on with the phone. And I don't know. I don't know. Do you know how to get to the phone through Skype?
We would.
You know what?
We'll check it out.
Yeah, we'll check it out. But the IMs are fired up, and we'll definitely take your IMs. But something not right with the phone. Let's see. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee.
Go to majority.fm, click become a member, and just join the show already. Come on, people.
Yeah, it's
just
time.
Just please.
It's time.
My God. I mean, if you absolutely have to be a freebie, if you absolutely have to listen to the free portion of the show, and then just, you know in your heart that even that free portion is only provided to you thanks to the members of the show, then at least what you could do is go to majorityreportkickback.com, and whenever you buy something off Amazon, buy it through that link, and you will be able to support the show without having to part with any extra funds from your fund pool.
Any extra funds from your fund pool. Okay. Also, download the app. Tell your friends about the app.
MajorityApp.com. Subscribe to us on YouTube. YouTube.com/SamCedar. Like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/MajorityReport. Follow us on Twitter @MajorityFM.
And we will see you in the fun half of the show.
We will.